This is one of those news stories that drives a lot of people crazy. It's a story about vaccines.
Some parents object to having their kids vaccinated, and since public health can be affected, other parents object to those who object.
In her new book of essays on immunity and inoculation, author Eula Biss looks at the history of anti-vaccination movements. She says she believes in giving children the full slate of modern vaccines, but when she had her son, Eula Biss found herself questioning those beliefs.
I was pregnant with my son, and I'd heard a few things about vaccination. I knew very little, and I thought I would do a small amount of research to answer some questions that had come up for me. And the questions just got bigger the more I learned and the more I read. I was really interested in how vaccination opens into all these other questions of environmentalism, questions of how we relate to our government, questions of citizenship. So long after I had answered my own personal questions, I found myself still really involved in the research.
You also, in writing about nascent movements in the United States, talk about the ways that this intersects with class and sometimes race. Can you give an example in the U.S. where you saw this?
I think I saw it first when I was researching the demographics of who does and doesn't vaccinate, but also who does and doesn't die of vaccine-preventable diseases. And one of the statistics that was interesting to me was that there's a group of people who don't vaccinate at all, who tend to be white, middle class, well-educated, and married mothers. And then there's a group of people whose children are undervaccinated, meaning they haven't received all of their vaccines. And that group of people is more likely to be black, to live below the poverty line, to be a mother who's not married and has recently moved. So this is a group of people who are not vaccinating, not because it's a choice or a position that they've taken, but because of the circumstances of their lives. And so this means that this relatively privileged population can end up spreading disease to people who haven't made that choice.
This issue is so highly politicized, and did you come to find any kind of middle ground?
That's an interesting question. But I actually, in writing this book, I became very wary of the idea of a middle ground. So, what I saw when I was doing research is that in pursuit of a middle ground, people will kind of split the difference between the two extremes that they're hearing. And I think what's problematic is that people are seeing vaccinating on schedule, on time, as an extreme position. So they're splitting the difference between that and the other extreme, which is not vaccinating at all, and doing partial or spaced out vaccinations. And I'm not actually convinced that that's a viable middle ground.
Why not?
Well, there's a great blog, Science Based Medicine, and one of the writers on that blog pointed out that when you split the difference between information and misinformation, you still end up with misinformation. So I think there are situations where a middle ground is not desirable, though I'm the kind of thinker who's very drawn to compromises and to nuances. I think in this particular area, the position that is sometimes seen as extreme, which is vaccinating a child fully and on time, I've come to believe is not an extreme position. I think that protecting children at the age where they're most vulnerable against diseases that are highly contagious is prudent.
Do you think the medical community has done enough to educate and to counter the information that's out there?
I think they're working very hard, and I think there's some great minds going at it. But I think that sometimes what the medical community is doing is too limited. And I don't think that's necessarily their fault. I think they're often addressing medical questions. And I don't think that this debate is always a medical debate. I think it's actually often not a medical debate. I think it's often a social debate. And I think that people's resistance to vaccination isn't going to disappear until we address some of the non-medical reasons for that resistance and people's discomfort and distrust of the government. That's bigger than what most medical professionals can handle.
By the end of the book, did you have a better sense of what is driving the modern anti-vaccination movement?
I think I had a better sense of how very complicated it is and how many different positions there are that feed this modern movement. And I'm not even sure it can be looked at as a cohesive movement. Some people have concerns that are really health-based, and some people are resisting capitalism when they resist vaccination. Some people are resisting what they feel is the corrupt pharmaceutical system and corrupt medical system. So there's all kinds of different angles here. And I do think I came to understand all of them better through this research. And I also came to understand my own reservations better. And really, the project of this book, it's a social critique, but it started out as a self-critique. I was curious about why I myself was reluctant to vaccinate my son. And that did give me some insight into why other people aren't vaccinating. And I would prefer for my son to have as little contact with the medical system as possible. I think vaccination is actually one way to try to help ensure that. So making sure that he doesn't get something like pneumonia that might mean a hospital stay, where things will be done to him that will make me uncomfortable, or that he will be treated in a way that might feel excessive to me. I think the best way for me to keep him out of that system is to engage in this highly effective preventative medicine.
Eula Biss, she's the author of On Immunity and Inoculation. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Audie Cornish.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Negotiators from Europe and the U.S. are meeting in Washington, trying again to reach a free trade agreement. The Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, or TTIP, would create the world's biggest free trade zone, but there is a problem here. Europeans are worried about American products, including American chicken. Susanna Capilouto reports.
Mutti Schimpf doesn't want to eat American chicken.
In Europe, there's definitely a disgust about chlorinated chicken.
Schimpf is with the group Friends of the Earth Europe. Chlorinated chicken is what she calls U.S. poultry, and she doesn't want it in Europe, where chlorine was banned in the 90s, out of fear that it could cause cancer. U.S. poultry is chilled in antimicrobial baths that can include chlorine to keep salmonella and other bacteria in check. Europeans now worry the TTIP treaty could bring them U.S. chicken. On the German equivalent of the Daily Show, it is called the Heute Show, U.S. poultry has become a running joke. In this skit, a reporter is in the White House kitchen eating a chicken nugget. He jokes, you can't be mad at someone who makes such a tasty chlorinated chicken. It has a slight aroma of kiddie pool, he quips.
Most of those concerns about, you know, chemical use and those kinds of things are blown up in the media to become a problem that really doesn't exist.
Scott Russell teaches poultry science at the University of Georgia. He says U.S. processors use about a capful of chlorine per gallon, or 50 parts per million, in a water tank that chills the chicken carcass. And that chlorine, he says, keeps chicken safe, gets washed off, and is no harm to consumers. Europeans, he says, use a different approach.
In Europe, their efforts at controlling foodborne illnesses is all in the live bird. For example, the grandparent stock, the breeder stock, all of those flocks of chickens are tested regularly for salmonella. If they're positive, they remove them, all of them.
And with this method, Europeans have reduced salmonella in their chicken to just 2%, says Russell, but it took nearly 20 years to get there. Europeans have pushed for some of the toughest food safety standards in the world. They want to eat fresh chicken that's air-chilled rather than dumped in chlorine water tanks, says Kes Vermeeren with the Association of the European Poultry Industry. We spoke via Skype.
The main principle of the food policy in the European Union is the so-called farm-to-fork approach. And you may say that's a bit fundamentally different in what's happening outside Europe in many places.
That strict food policy makes poultry production more expensive. A study by Wageningen University in the Netherlands shows it takes about a dollar in Europe to produce a pound of chicken. The U.S. can do it for less than 80 cents. James Sumner is president of the U.S. Poultry Export Council. He says over 120 countries accept the U.S. processing method. It's cheaper, and Europe, he says, doesn't want U.S. competition.
If the truth were to be known, that's the real reason they don't want us there, and chlorine is a convenient excuse.
For activists like Mutter Schimpf, who are trying to sway the public to reject a big treaty that's full of legal jargon and complicated regulations, the chicken argument works.
So to simplify it, in Europe, very often the chlorinated chicken is used as a symbol to describe what European consumers and citizens don't want to have as an outcome from the trade talks.
Besides changes in chicken production, activists are also fighting the possibility of hormone-treated beef and genetically engineered crops on the European market should TTIP succeed. The talks between the U.S. and the EU are held in secret, but any agreement needs the nod of the European Parliament, which is elected by a public that worries a lot about its food supply. For NPR News, I'm Susanna Capoluto in Atlanta.
We're going to hear now about two of the most controversial words in education these days, screen time. One fear about screen time is that it's hurting kids' social skills. On Morning Edition today, we heard about a recent experiment. Researchers found that kids who spent time away from electronic devices got better at reading emotions on people's faces. But for some educators, screen time isn't all bad. Corey Turner of the NPR Ed team has the story of one Los Angeles school that's embracing technology in an effort to protect kids from it.
Yay! Can you say good morning, Ms. Vogelstrom?
Good morning, Ms. Vogelstrom.
The hallways are humming with kids at Westside Neighborhood School. It's morning. A gaggle of first graders has wrapped up breakfast and heads to class. WNS is an independent school, pre-K through 8th, tucked into the shadow of a Home Depot in LA's booming Playa Vista neighborhood. It's close enough to the ocean that the air is more salt than smog.
So our third grade is on this side, and here is the lab right here.
I get the grand two-story tour from Judith Joy. She's executive assistant to the head of school, and she walks me to the technology lab.
So you can see we have a room full of computers, and then on the side we have our nice little robots that the kids get to play with and tinker around with. And you should see the stuff they create. It is really awesome.
We'll come back to the lab in a minute, but first, the man behind Westside's pretty radical technology policy, head of school Brad Zacuto. When it comes to talking about screen time and kids' access to handheld devices, he likes to use an old-fashioned analogy.
It's like putting a child behind a wheel of a car. There's a lot of power there.
Zacuto says, think about how dangerous it was back when cars first hit the road. No traffic lights or street signs. Well, that's where we are now, he says, with kids and all this technology at their fingertips.
It's here to stay. But at some point, you have to teach kids how to drive a car responsibly.
How does he do that? First, no smartphones till sixth grade. Even then, kids can bring them to school, but they have to check them at the front desk. Second, by engaging and educating parents. WNS makes them sign a commitment to limit screen time at home and to keep kids off of social media, again, till sixth grade. Also at school, no technology at all until second grade.
We choose to have our youngest children engaged in digging in dirt and building things and using their hands.
Not just hands, but eyeballs and brains, too, interacting with other kids face to face. Because they need lots of early practice relating, reading emotion, and responding to it. Screen time just gets in the way. In second grade, Zacuto says, kids start using classroom laptops. They get some basic lessons in typing and word processing, and their first taste of internet research, which makes this a good time to go back to that technology lab.
Hi, how's it going? Don Fitzroy, nice to meet you, Don.
Don Fitzroy is EdTech coordinator at Westside Neighborhood School. By fourth grade, just about every student has sat through a class like this.
So we're going to be talking about digital citizenship today. And I wanted to begin by giving you guys an opportunity to watch a short video about something called a digital footprint.
The idea is to get kids to think hard about the dangers of social media before they have Twitter handles or Facebook pages. After the video, Fitzroy sits in a half circle with a handful of students and talks through a cautionary tale.
They say something online, and then suddenly they say, I'm going to delete this. I know I changed my mind. I didn't mean to say that. And it's out there.
13-year-old Tom Zimmerman gets it.
One example, this one kid who was like in this room and he had like this fake lightsaber and he was acting really crazy and it looked really stupid. And it was funny, but I'm sure that kid won't want it in the future, but so many people have taken that video and put it on their channels that there's no way of getting rid of it.
That video of one kid in a heated lightsaber battle with himself is pretty amazing. He's swinging a golf ball retriever, and he's just so intense about it. High-stepping, swatting the floor, losing his balance. It's been watched millions of times. But the so-called Star Wars kid, now in his 20s, says he was bullied because of it and had to leave school, which gives principals like Brad Zacuto not one, but two big reasons to worry about screen time. Because of what's not happening, important face-to-face time, and because of what is happening, kids putting themselves out there in embarrassing and potentially dangerous ways. Which raises the question, what is good screen time?
It's all about how things are used and how much they're used and what they're used for.
Patricia Greenfield co-authored that study we mentioned in the intro. She's a professor of psychology at UCLA and has been writing about screen time for 30 years. She says, for example, asking kids to write an essay using the computer can be a good thing. It can help with spelling and grammar, and they can use the internet for research. Here's the key.
You're not substituting screen time for interaction time. You're substituting alone time with the screen for alone time with your paper and pen.
Greenfield describes a kind of cost-benefit analysis. Is this screen time coming at the expense of face-to-face time? And what unique value does the technology add? At Westside Neighborhood School, when kids use tech, often they're still working collaboratively and doing things they couldn't do without it. Again, head of school, Brad Zacuto.
We have a design class where they imagine a product, they design it, and we have a 3D printer where they then create it. I mean, there's amazing things going on that's preparing them for the world they're going into.
Another simpler example, math homework. Kids in the same class but at different skill levels can do work that matches their ability. And starting in sixth grade, Zacuto students can do it all on school-issued tablets. Some teachers even put short lectures online for students to watch at home.
It sort of flips the content. I'd rather be spending my time in school with the teacher, with the kids, doing interactive collaborative using what we've learned.
Which, oddly enough, means using screens to increase the time kids at WNS spend working face-to-face. It's a delicate dance, preparing kids for both the digital age and the social world. But it's important not to sacrifice one for the other, says Yelda Uhls, who co-authored that screen time study with Patricia Greenfield. When kids hit middle school, she says, the balance of power in their lives tilts away from their parents toward friends.
One of the reasons it's so miserable is because we're trying to learn our place in the social world outside of our safe little haven at home.
The more practice kids get, reading emotion in voices and posture, the better they'll be able to navigate the turmoil of early adolescence. And that kind of learning just won't fit in the palm of your hand. Corey Turner, NPR News, Washington.
And let's take a moment for heavy rotation. Each month, as regular listeners know, NPR Music asks public radio DJs and hosts to name a favorite new song, and each month we feature one on this program. Today we're going to hear from David Dye of WXPN's World Cafe. His pick is called Eyes of the Muse by King Tuff.
King Tuff is the name de rock for Kyle Thomas, a multi-instrumentalist musician originally from Brattleboro, Vermont, and he moved to Los Angeles and has a new album called Black Moon Spell.
Coming at midnight into my window.
This song, Eyes of the Muse, just immediately grabbed me. Even from the intro, I got a big grin on my face. It reminds me a lot of music I loved from the 60s, the 70s, in a genre called power pop or garage rock. It's really kind of primitive but highly melodic rock and roll. I've got a whole stack of CDs as I try to arrange every show. And this is one, it never makes its way to the bottom. I always pull it out because I think it just sounds great on the radio. In fact, that's one of the things that people have said over the years about this power pop genre, that DJs really love it. I think we love the fact that it's a real blast of melodic fun. I'm hoping it sounds great being in a car and listening to this on a gorgeous late summer day.
David Dye of WXPN's World Cafe. His pick is Eyes of the Muse by King Tuff, and you can hear more recommendations at npr.org/music. It's NPR News.
Over the years, as women have gained financial and social independence, they've had a profound effect on the workplace and the economy. We're exploring that impact in our series about the changing lives of women. And for this installment, we'll start with the single ladies.
When I turned 21 and still wasn't married, my mother officially declared me an old maid.
And I'm gonna be 40!
In 8 years.
But it's there!
You know, married women are threatened because we can have sex anytime, anywhere, with anyone.
What are your plans for Valentine's Day, Lemon?
I am taking myself out of the equation entirely. I scheduled a root canal for February 14th, Jack. I will spend half the day in twilight sleep, then I will go home and watch the Lifetime original movie, My Stepson is My Cyber Husband.
Pop culture images of the single woman has been a mixed bag. It's evolved from Mary Tyler Moore to When Harry Met Sally and later Sex and the City to 30 Rock's Liz Lemon. Writer Rebecca Traister says until very recently, it was marriage that marked the beginning of a woman's adult life. But in the last few decades, there's been a dramatic jump in the average age women get married, from around age 22 to nearly 27, with major effects.
We have now shifted our vision of what an adult woman's life path usually entails. And it now entails some period of economic, social, sexual independence.
Traister is a senior editor at The New Republic. She's working on a book about unmarried women. She says while the shift in marriage patterns is mostly a good thing for women, at times it's also been viewed as a destabilizing force in society.
The lack of marriage is being blamed for almost every social ill, whether it's gun violence, whether it's poverty, whether it's the dropping birth rate. You have demographers worried about the fact that as people marry later, they're having fewer children. Single women come in for an enormous amount of blame politically and culturally. So that's one set of messages. Another set is this kind of glamorization, whether it's Sex and the City, which is now 10 years old, or whether it's The New Girl or Mindy Kaling. You see all new depictions of women living independently and having interesting, varied lives.
So you're finishing up a book right now on single women, and you've talked to many single women. What is the reality that they're living out?
Well, the reality is much more complicated. I mean, I think we make a mistake when we create a binary between you're either married or you're unmarried. Once you lift the imperative that everybody get married at age 22, what you get is an infinite variety of paths. It's not simply some argument that single life is inherently better than married life. The fact is there are all kinds of married lives and all kinds of single lives, and more people are now free to go down a variety of paths.
At the same time, it was always believed that economic wealth and even kind of culturally that happiness was attributed, right, to being in a marriage. And certainly politically, that has been the message, that marriage makes lives better, particularly for people who are struggling financially. Are people looking at that differently? Has that messaging changed?
Well, solid marriages do make many lives happier. But finding a solid marriage, as many of us know, isn't something that happens easily. And the idea that marriage simply as marriage, finding a partner, if you're talking heterosexually, finding a man, is going to improve your emotional or economic life is a real myth. And the imperative that you find that partner in order to have a complete or happy life can lead you down a very dangerous path. Because, of course, marriage to just another person isn't necessarily going to improve your life. In fact, it may make your life much worse if you have a poor emotional connection, no emotional connection, if that person is struggling economically in the same way that you are, if that person is in any way abusive. All these things are realities lived every day by married people. So marriage in and of itself isn't a cure for poverty or unhappiness. Good marriages, economically stable marriages, emotionally rewarding marriages, are a tremendous perk for people.
So you've called this a mass shift. What are the implications of that?
Well, you basically have the creation of a new population. One clear example is that single women actually in 2012 made up 23% of the electorate. And they voted overwhelmingly for Barack Obama over Mitt Romney. You have women who are earning money in places where they'd never earned money before. You have women who are single who are having babies out of wedlock. More than 50% of first births are now to unmarried women. It destabilizes the power structures that had existed before. Because to have women living independently in these ways, voting, having babies, earning money, it removes some of the power that had traditionally belonged to men who have long been in economic and political power.
How much of this is basically about the economy across the board, that people are making this choice not necessarily because they want to? I mean, a survey conducted by the Pew Research Center showed that marriage is still a life goal. How does this reconcile?
Well, I think the fact that women have unprecedented economic opportunity, that, you know, they are now permitted to, and in fact, in many cases, expected to go out and earn money. They are busy doing other things. That does not mean that many women and men don't still have the desire to partner, to fall in love. But the actual economic tolls of marriage and motherhood, which are very real, mean that often they're electing not to take on those tolls of marriage and motherhood early in their careers when they are now in a position to be out stabilizing themselves economically.
You mean it takes you out of the running for those jobs, or it hurts your earning power, and so women are saying, you know what, I'm just not going to do it?
Right, or I'm not going to do it right now. It's not necessarily politicized. It's a human sense of, I don't want to get tied down and distracted by my emotional life right now as I'm establishing myself as an adult. That doesn't mean that the desire for love, partnership, and companionship is removed. The kinds of strategic choices that women across classes are making about when to marry, when to have children, how to commit themselves to their career, how to make money, doesn't mean that any of them don't yearn for companionship. But there are also a series of practical choices now available to them, ways of balancing the different things they can do with their lives, that often mean that marriage doesn't necessarily have to come first, and that, in fact, in many cases, it doesn't make strategic sense for marriage to come first.
Well, Rebecca Traister, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Rebecca Traister is the author of Big Girls Don't Cry. In the coming weeks, we'll explore more about the changing lives of women with a dive into the worlds of beauty and power, fashion, and comedy.